Farmers markets are the largest access point to local food systems, playing a critical role in our communities. Many markets, though, have taken a devastating hit due to the pandemic. At a time when a historic number of Americans are facing food insecurity and COVID-19 issues continuing to impact the supply chain, the ability for the average person to get fresh, local food looks even more grim. What would our world look like without farmers markets? Hello, I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Impact Earth Food. And everybody, this is the first time we've covered this topic, and I really am very excited to have this guest with us that's going to talk about farmers markets and how they are a key to local food security. And for any longtime listeners, you know about food security, food insecurity, food deserts. It's a real thing, and it's just, to me, accelerating, and it's something we have to pay attention to. And we have someone with us who knows quite a bit about this. So please join me in welcoming Brian Copham, Executive Director, Boulder County Farmers Markets. Brian came to local agriculture as a refugee from a life pursuing material success. He has applied his previous business experience to the nonprofit mission of promoting local growers and supporting the connections with their community. 3 years after embracing the simple importance of local farming, Brian has experienced the unexpected but not unpleasant irony of being awarded CEO of the Year by Colorado Biz Magazine. Brian, it is really great to have you here, and I wish we had recorded the whole pre-session because that was as much fun as the show might be.
Well, thank you, Gene. I'm just really happy to be here, and certainly you have interviewed some amazing guests, so I'm honored and really looking forward to this conversation.
Well, I'm honored to have you here, and I mean that. I really want to get into the whole farmers market thing, but of course I have to know, we have to start with why the irony of being awarded CEO of the Year. Was it just like a non sequitur for you, or is it mostly a business magazine? What was the irony?
Oh, dear. Well, this really digs into my history of, as you mentioned in the introduction, of pursuing material wealth and really, you know, having grown up in the 80s with the period of, what was the show, Wall Street,
yes.
Where there was this villain that was written as a villain who's destroying businesses, but he's filthy rich, and he really kind of became a hero to the people in my generation, the men in my generation. And, you know, there's so many people that went to business school and then went to Wall Street. And my father was a lifelong entrepreneur. And so we had been raised to believe in a little bit of magical thinking and kind of the, if you work hard, you know, we're going to be rich someday.
Right.
And I had pursued that for so long and really was not very good at it. And perhaps even worse, it really didn't make me happy. I felt very much in the background. I didn't really believe in what I was doing outside of helping myself. And so there was a point in about 2012 where I decided I really needed to do something different. And this is where the irony kind of comes in, is that in 2013, I applied for this job with the farmers market. And for me,
that was
a complete admission of failure. I knew, I was like, okay, I'm basically, all my friends who've been very successful they just know it. I'm a failure. And I'm gonna just sit with it and I'm gonna live with it and it's gonna be okay. And that felt so relieving. And of course, I got the job and my friends were congratulating me. They were authentically excited, which still confuses me, frankly.
They were probably jealous at some level, doing something you love as opposed to doing something to make money.
I don't really know, but I was really pleased with their reaction. And then it was the following year. Well, I guess it had been about 18 months I was on the job, and I had finally let my ego go. You know, that's what I thought, at least. And I walked into the office, and my staff member said, hey, congratulations. And I was like, okay, thank you. You know, like, whatever. I'm going to my office. And he said, no, really. And then the others chimed in, congratulations. There's somebody called and said your name's Colorado CEO of the Year. And I was like, yeah, whatever. Like, I got stuff to do. And so they persisted, and I called the Denver Business Journal, who issues this award, and I questioned the woman on the other line for like 10 minutes. Like, who are you? Like, if I call this number back, are you going to answer it? Is this legitimate? And when I found out it was legitimate, I just had a sinking feeling like I finally gave it up. I finally was letting go of, you know, wanting to be on the front of a magazine.
Right, right.
And here it is. And is it going to screw everything up? Because I really love what I'm doing right now.
It's life-changing. Oh, my gosh. We do have so much in common. So I have a show, a third podcast called A Place for Us. And I think you should come back on as a guest. There's no pre-questions. There's just talking about journeys. And I think you and I could really talk about the similarities in our journeys. So thank you for sharing that with me. And I get it. And I resemble that remark. And we have something here called Biz Tucson. And when I was featured in that, after my step away from the corporate world, I was really proud. I really was. I admit it, because everybody has some pride. And I was very proud. So yeah. When I say that I'm really excited about a show, and my team has kind of coached me on that, because I say that a lot about our shows. And the reason is because I'm really excited. But in this particular case, I went a little bit deeper about the whole farmers market thing and my lack of consciousness about them when the pandemic hit. There were so many other things to consider. So this brought it front and center to me. So I might ask you some questions that you don't have the answer to, but I never play stump the guest, and it's okay to say, I don't know. And I wanted to start with, do you have any sense at all, even a wild guess, about how many farmers markets were in operation pre-COVID? Is there even a system for counting that?
Oh, my goodness. I think the last time I looked at the USDA statistics, there were about 7,000 farmers markets operating across the U.S.
Wow. Yeah, that's a big number. I mean, that's pre-COVID, I'm sure. And I agree with you. I think it's very safe to say that farmers market are, without question, the largest access point to local food systems. I know they play a critical role in our communities. So now the pressure question, are they coming back? Has COVID devastated them to the point of extinction? What's happening in that arena? What are you seeing?
Well, we won't really know for a little bit. Many of the markets have a relatively short season. Of course, in California, you have markets that are operating year-round.
Right.
And from what I understand, those markets continue to operate, that they have weathered the storm. In other areas, you have markets that are really six-month markets, maybe even a five-month market. And so we don't really know for those kinds of markets how they fared. I think in general, they perhaps had less opportunity to take advantage of some of the relief programs that were in place. When you have a five-month market, it's often going to be volunteer labor driven, and they didn't have a PPP for volunteer labor. So it was difficult for people to recoup any of the losses that they saw in 2020. But a lot of markets lost money. I know that for certain. The government assistance has been critical. The PPP loan was absolutely instrumental for us in managing our finances. We lost a considerable sum of money in 2020. But we are in a good position to continue this year because of the assistance that was offered. I fear that far too many markets will not. But we won't know yet until we get into the season, just a little bit deeper.
A little bit deeper. And I was thinking about, like, the things that I love about our farmers market. There's one that I go to. And I thought about these two guys that make my soap. And they have a special kind of foot scrub. And I ran out. I didn't know where to get them because I only got them at the farmers market. So I think of those businesses that obviously do not have a large profit margin. And to, or, you know, financial reserves. It's just like I said, I really went a lot deeper on this conversation because I thought, you haven't even thought about that. I had other things to think about, like keeping Mrs. Green's world alive. But anyway,
sure.
And not dying. That was a big one for me, too, till I got vaccinated. So from where I sit and knowing, I think, like, enough to be dangerous about food insecurity and food deserts and food security, I can't imagine if more farmers market don't make it, how will the average person have access to fresh local food? Like, I live for the heirloom tomatoes. There's so many other things that are fresh that you just don't even, I don't even look at them in the grocery store. So what are you seeing in terms of food insecurity compounded with COVID-19 issues impacting this supply chain? How are average people going to get local produce?
Well, COVID has been really interesting because it has, of course, caused so much upset in our systems. And the local food system is the same way. And when I say upset, I don't necessarily mean to a negative extent. And in many ways, I suppose it's been disruptive. What we saw in 2020 was that farmers who already had a direct-to-consumer channel, so that means they sold at the farmer's market or they had a farm stand or perhaps they were even doing some online or CSAs. These are operations that already knew how to talk with their customers. They already had a line of communication. And as soon as they sent out the communication that their farm stand was open, people were lined up, you know, 20 deep to buy produce because, of course, at the beginning of the pandemic, the grocery stores were failing and people were turning to the local food system, and it really stimulated a lot of interest and demand. We have one grower who typically has a CSA of about 225, 250 shares.
Right.
And they expanded to 900 shares in 2020 because the demand was so high. So I think some of those channels have been built because of COVID, but those are somewhat restricted. They're really important and valuable channels to be able to go on the farm, see the farm, pick up your CSA, really kind of have a more in-depth relationship with the farmers, really a beautiful thing. And those kinds of channels can support that. But the farmers markets tend to have a lot of farmers and a lot of choice and a lot of variety and a lot of energy. When those go away, there's kind of this fracturing in the system. People will determine, okay, where can I sell? Where can they sell? And some of the efficiency of purchasing is lost. So as a consumer, we used to have a CSA. It's actually how I was introduced to the market, was through a CSA. And we really enjoyed it. But over time, I really grew to love all of the choices I had at the farmers market and knowing I was supporting more of a whole system rather than an individual part of the system. So I feel like a lot of communities, we're fortunate here, of course, in close to Boulder, Colorado, in Boulder County, we have a lot of market farmers, market scale farmers. A lot of communities don't, and these farmers travel in from a fair distance, you know, maybe 30, 40, 50 miles or 100 miles to be there. When that goes away, people aren't going to drive 100 miles to get a CSA at that farm.
Nope, they're not. And I think about it because I've been only to, like, when we are on vacation and we find out there's a farmer's market, of course we always go. But living here, there's a really big, successful one that's close to us that we go to. And then we were in Taos, New Mexico last summer. And, you know, I kind of want to get into the benefits of farmer's market eventually, because you know there's so many more things than just buying some fresh tomatoes. Mm-hmm. But do you want to expand on those a little bit? Because it's not just about, it's everything I talk about in terms of Mrs. Green's world and the connection to everything. It's all connected. I mean, we're all made of carbon. It's all connected. We're all breathing the same air. So can you talk a little bit about why farmers markets are essential connections to the local food system? What are some of the big benefits that you see? Because it's not just about getting fresh tomatoes.
Right. Right. I think often as a culture, we tend to see the markets as a transactional kind of event,
right,
like the grocery store. And this is where comparisons always fall apart, with people saying, well, I can buy it cheaper in the grocery store, which often is not true.
Right.
But it is the mythology, because, of course, every once in a while, a farmer charges $12 for a bunch of asparagus. And it's all that anybody remembers is that one time that farmer charged that.
Right.
But often the food is at times less than the grocery store, or it's just slightly more. We have found when it is more, it's about 13% more. But we get into these transactional arguments. Where can I get it for less? And the assumption there, first of all, is that we're talking about the same thing. And generally, we're not. When we're, you know, tomatoes are such a great example, because a bad tomato really is pretty bad.
It's really bad. It's like eating hard rubber.
It really is. It's an unpleasant experience. And then we wonder why our kids don't like vegetables.
Right.
But a good tomato is absolutely wonderful. And to suggest that they're the same is wrong.
It's ridiculous.
Right. I mean, at a good market, you have growers who are bringing freshly harvested, field-ripened produce, which has all of the sugars, all of the flavors that it's really developed from being on the vine, being in the ground, as long as it has, until it was ready, and picked right before it was brought to the market. And then, of course, that same produce gets all that extra nutrition from developing over time with the sun and the earth,
right,
and healthy soil. And that nutrition is represented in all of these compounds I'm not even sure we understand yet, but that lend flavor and experience to what we're getting. One of the things we talk about with food access is in terms of the value of buying from the local food system for individuals who are in the low-income spectrum and often have a hard time affording food in any location, including the market. One of the benefits of buying from the local food system is that the kids actually love it. And most people in the household are going to love the food because it actually tastes good.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, when we're talking about the need to really change long-term, lifelong eating habits, loving it is a really big part of that. So it can have that impact. But I think maybe, Gina, what you're also kind of suggesting, which really becomes important, is, well, in fact, if you aren't suggesting it, that's okay too, because I'm going to run with it.
I'm going to let you know if I was or not.
Fair enough. The idea of community, where,
yes,
this, you know, there's these, it's just so incredibly powerful, simple, and yet difficult to explain sometimes. But I strongly feel that as organisms, we developed in this environment that was a very close connection to nature. For thousands and thousands of years, we were intimately connected to nature. And then with the Industrial Revolution and the move to the cities and mass manufacturing and the idea that our lives need to be spent productively producing something rather than enjoying something, we slowly lost that connection to nature to the point where now most people, we don't know where our food comes from anymore. But when we engage in the local food system, in my mind, we're using the farmer. When we go and buy directly from the farmer, we're using the farmer as a conduit back to earth. And that is a grounding experience. That is, when we eat that food, it is a grounding experience. And when we're grounded, we feel safe. We feel safe with one another, which is why I think dinner parties are typically a better way to entertain than just come over and chat parties.
Totally, totally.
We're sharing that nourishment.
Right, we gather around food.
Yes, really, exactly.
We do.
And the food, particularly when the food is not only physically nourishing, but it's also nourishing our minds with the information of the difference between a daikon radish and a French breakfast radish. And we're nourishing our kind of our souls with this connection to something that's ancient, this ancient cellular memory that we have of being with the earth. When we feel that safe, we're now open to connecting with each other. And I think that's why the farmers markets often have such a beneficial effect on just this idea of, like, I belong to a community. It's my community's right here. I don't know all these people, but I know some of them, and I know I like all these people because we share something really important in common.
You know, it's so interesting to me because as you're sitting there, I almost lost you because I'm thinking about, seriously, because I'm thinking about what is that feeling that I could almost not describe when I am at the farmers market in Taos, which is a much smaller community, and there's kids everywhere, there's dogs, there's families, there's grandmas, there's grandpas. It's just joyful, and kids are eating fresh carrots that their parents gave them, and there's a place, a bakery that does just unbelievable, really great whole grain bread. And there, it's joyful. I mean, it is just joyful. You can't even put your hand on it, but if you could bottle it, you could. We could, hey, Brian, we could get back to that, you know, the six-figure income really fast. But it is that feeling, and it isn't just about food. You're right. It's about the connection and community. And when I first started this journey, I mean, I'm really going off on a tangent here, but you bring that out at me, so I'm totally blaming the guest. I went to a conference, and it was based a lot on the Pachamama beliefs. And this man came, Michael Green, who's very well known in terms of his artwork. And he talked about, this was 14 years ago, Brian. And he said, what is going to happen is that we are going to have to go back to small communities of 120 or less, because the way that we have built things out is not sustainable. So what do you see? I mean, here we see a migration out of the cities. People don't want to be in, you know, high-rise buildings. And I think it's that starvation for that sense. Oh, my God, I love hearing the chickens. Full disclaimer, everybody, we told Brian, stay outside with the chickens. We're good with that. We love it. Like, this is Mrs. Green's world, so I love it. But then back to the, like, okay, down from the dream cloud, there's really serious economic viability to having robust and healthy farmers markets. They give people jobs, right? They put money in the local economy. There's just so many good things, healthy food, healthy jobs, all of things like that. Is there anything you want to expand on that? I mean, it's just absolutely the truth.
It is. You're absolutely right. They contribute to local economies. They act as incubators for local businesses. They introduce businesses to the community. They generate jobs. And they also generate a fair deal of caring within these businesses in terms of how they're interacting with the community and what they're giving and what they're getting. There's a, you know, one of the interesting outcomes of this, or at least related threads, is there's an organization here locally called the Slow Money Institute.
Oh, yes, Slow Money.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the founder, Woody Tash, lives in this area.
Oh my gosh, when I come visit you, I can meet Woody. I've heard him speak.
Absolutely, you can definitely meet Woody.
Yeah. I've heard him speak.
Yeah, he's wonderful. And he had this idea for a group which he calls SOIL, which is Slow Opportunities for Investing Locally. And really what this is community members putting donations into a pot and then making 0% loans to farmers out of that pot.
Wow.
And yep. It's an example of how the spirit of a farmer's market can manifest in other ways, that the community takes care of itself at the farmer's market. We, you know, I'm buying from my neighbor. My neighbor is growing food for me. And I think there's a lot of ways we can think about and really do need to think about getting off of the global train and taking a look, closer look to where we live and who our neighbors are and building some meaning right here where we are.
And it's like bingo, and I feel like ringing the bell because it's so spot on. But in terms of other benefits, let's go just a little bit down the rabbit hole on that, because I just did a training today on carbon, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And there's good things that happen when there's local farms in terms of sequestering carbon. Mm-hmm. There's other things like flood and drought mitigation. You know, my favorite movie right now on the hit parade of Mrs. Green's World is Kiss the Ground. And I interviewed the producer, and we're staying in touch. But it's all about regenerative agriculture, which to me, when I watched the movie, I thought, there is hope. If we do this, we will right. sequester carbon. We will have healthy food. Flood and drought mitigation will be an absolute byproduct of all of it. Pollinator, no problem. Ecosystem health, no problem. But we're not there yet. So it's all about a food system helping to keep the planet healthy, not just the citizens on it. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Ecosystem services, when we think about the paying for tomato, back to the tomato, and this idea of comparing the tomato here to the one in the grocery store, you know, tomato's a tomato. What we often don't think about is how that tomato was grown and how that is impacting our future.
Right, and who grew it, at what right. cost.
Exactly. 80% of our farmers have second streams of income. They have off-farm jobs in order to be able to afford to farm, because it's very hard to farm. We live in a culture where, as I have grown to say repeatedly, we expect food to be dirt cheap and farmers to be dirt poor.
I know.
And it's really, this is one of the root, in my mind, one of the root causes of the environmental degradation that we have seen, is that it's all about production, 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 production at any cost. And so it becomes, farming becomes an extractive venture, just like mining or drilling for oil. We're just taking value out of the land and then distributing it to people. And in our system, that value doesn't return. It doesn't even return to the rural communities. I mean, to be honest, of course, the farmers in those situations very rarely are making a killing, if even a living. So it's this idea of, like, I can choose to buy from someone whose practices actually do build soil. And it does mitigate flooding. And it does help mitigate drought. And it does build pollinator habitat and ecosystem yes. health and biodiversity
yep.
and all and sequester carbon. All the things that we talk about that we want. I mean, most people, let me back that up. Many people, you know, really understand that this is important. This is the way life used to be. It wasn't that we always just took and never gave back. And we need to get back to giving back. But are we willing to pay for it? And for that farmer who is growing that way, I've seen it at the market, people getting upset at their prices, which are, you know, like, I don't know, 10% above what you could get at the natural foods grocery store, if even that. But just, like, inflamed about the prices. And until we as a culture are willing to participate by paying the true cost of growing food, gosh, Gina, it's always going to be a struggle.
It's always going to be like this. And to your point, some of those people do that. I've seen it. And then they go buy a $7 latte.
Wait
a minute. Excuse me. Did you want to reframe your budget spending? And
yeah.
that's an exciting journey for me to help try and raise consciousness with people about green is more expensive, because most of the time it absolutely and positively is not. If you look at the whole loop, the whole circular loop of better health and cleaner food and keeping money in the economy, it's just pennies on the dollar more for all of the good things that come back and benefit. Here in the Southwest, we are pretty blessed. We have Native Seed Search, and we have a big research facility on a place called Tumamoc Hill. And there are many, many food security experts at the U of A. And what another thing I think people don't understand, and it's not because of stupidity, it's because who talks about this? It's we saw the impact of COVID on shipping of goods. Okay, everything that you want to have done, it's held up. The boats are backed up. This has happened. The production is slower because of one pandemic. Well, what do you think is going to happen with more severe droughts, more severe flooding? If we don't start building our local food systems, we are going to be literally in food deserts waiting for the truck. And that's going to be all of us.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We need to get our arms around this and change the way we think. And I think it's a little harsh to say I blame, but I would say there's an individual that I'd like to say represents this old thinking. And that is, do you remember the little girl on the shake and bake commercial?
That's not chicken. That's shake and bake.
Yeah. When she says, and I helped.
And I helped. Yes.
Yep. So, you know, you've got the husband there who is eating the chicken and loving it and saying, hey, your chicken's always good, but this is amazing what you do. And mom's explaining that she didn't do what she usually does, which is really make it from scratch. She is using the shake and bake recipe. And that we, in that moment, we learned that, you know, this factory in Iowa can cook better than mom with her home fried chicken.
Oh my gosh.
And it's so easy that even a 9-year-old can do it.
Right. And don't read the ingredients of what is in shake and bake, because I have had it. I admit it. Like, I can be a bottom feeder, but not anymore. I haven't had shake and bake in a decade.
I haven't either. Oh. And we have been truly kind of indoctrinated in this idea that food is cheap and dealing with food is beneath us, that we could be spending time being productive, making money, adding to society instead of cooking.
I know, and the difference in carbon footprint, because we this training I did today, so it's fresh on my mind, the difference between one home-cooked meal versus one fast food meal in terms of CO2 impact, it's ridiculous. It's like 600-something pounds compared to 1,300 pounds if you buy fast food because of all that goes in it. So let's go on this thread that you brought up. I'm going to totally blame you about blame, because I have been saying to people lately, you know, I always thought I was really a nice person, but on certain issues these days, I'm not really very nice. So let's talk about farming. Okay?
Okay.
Because to me, there's two kinds of farming. There's big ag and everything else. And big ag gets all kinds of support from the U.S. government, like hundreds of millions of dollars, let's be honest. And our food supply is subsidized by us without really knowing it necessarily. Right. So I'm not a big ag fan, to put it mildly. So in Arizona, I'll bring it on home to you. We have a lot of Saudis buying land and growing alfalfa. And it is not anything against the Saudis. It's that they have so much money and have so little water that they found land in Arizona. And we should not be growing alfalfa anywhere. We also have a big cotton industry. We should not be growing cotton there either. And the farmers are going to get a big hit. It's on all the news stations for the past week and a half because we're implementing drought protocols. So, Brian, I'm sitting there and I'm saying, I just can't feel pity right now. It's like, you had to see this coming. Why didn't you start growing pinto beans or something? So what's your thought about farming, as it would have to be arguably the whitest profession in the United States? So, you know, big ag, little farmers, farmers markets, make it all make sense to me.
Well, it doesn't make sense in my mind. And there's so many, there's a few different threads that I think you've really kind of pulled on here. One is the system of agriculture, which in our country really did start with the westward expansion, the Homestead Act,
right,
the Morrell Act, and really, you know, forcibly taking away land, violently taking away land from the people who are on it, and then redistributing it to white settlers, and then using slave labor to farm and build wealth for the farm owners,
right,
on that land.
Right.
And so you're right, farming is the whitest profession in the United States, and that it was designed to be that way. It was very specifically designed to be that way. And as I think the economic success of the United States grew, the idea that farming is part of an economic system, not a food system.
Right, right.
It's part of an economic system. I think that idea grew as well. So it was really about GDP and who's exporting the most and how can we increase exports? How do we get more of our neighbors' money into our community by selling food to them? And the other side of that, as you mentioned, you know, there's big ag, which in many ways I think serves that economic system. And then there's the food system, which is what we see at the farm stands or at CSAs,
right,
or the,
right,
farmers markets. And we're learning that there's a pretty broad gap between the two when you think of the fact that these rural communities that are home to these large-scale operations, commodity operations, often have horrible access to just to freshly grown foods.
Right, right.
It's really, the system is out of balance. It's gone way out of balance. And I love the local food system. I'm an absolute proponent of it. My intention is not that 100% of our food should be local. I would be thrilled if 10% of our food was local.
What a shift that would be. It would be monumental,
yeah,
in terms of job creation, everything, the health of our economy. 10% shift, huge.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love guacamole.
Me too.
We don't have avocados in Colorado. And I'm going to buy avocados. But with the local food system, the interesting thing is I've started to think about, well, whose avocados am I buying? What am I supporting wherever they come from, Mexico or California? And I think we will continue to see that trend, that as consumers, as we as citizens become more attuned to how impactful food choices are on our lives and will be on the lives of our children, that we'll start to ask more insightful questions, which unfortunately also make it ripe for kind of local washing and fair trade washing and, you know, these things that often are misused. But nonetheless, they're the right questions for us to ask.
And we have to keep asking them. And it's interesting, my daughter and her husband and my granddaughter, he's working for the Forest Service, and he has an internship in a place called Happy Camp, California. And you have to have a magnifying glass to see it on the map. But they are healthy eaters. All of my children are healthy eaters. Mm. And she does not give, you know, my granddaughter, nothing ever came out of a jar. She made all her food. She continues to make her food. And they go an hour and a half each way to the grocery store because in Happy Camp, there's no fresh produce. And so that to me is a market-driven reality. And eventually, if more people do that, I think we'll see more change accelerate. So I have two more big ones for you to answer. I always like to ask people that are in your role and have what I would call a very, a really integrated global look at the reality of thinking globally, acting locally. And I always want to know, what's it going to take? Is it going to take more public policy so that we are saying to our legislators, stop supporting big ag, start supporting regenerative agriculture? And I do have a good update on that. Support local farmers. How much can change in the public policy role versus the public advocacy role? It's always, where do you push the most, or is it both?
Well, I think it's really both. The policy becomes, I think, really important because our industries tend to follow government money. I mean, to be honest, it's when
so
there are
true.
When there are new technologies, you know, the government really decides which one's going to win if they're competing. And I think in the same way, farming and agriculture will follow government money. And if the government, if the federal government can get into a space of really having thoughtful support with a different lens on the outcomes. So maybe the outcomes aren't production anymore. Maybe it's really more about nutrition and health or ecosystems. You know, there's all kinds of lenses we can apply. That would make a huge difference, absolutely a huge difference, because there's not enough in farming, not enough money in farming to have a whole lot of R&D, and I'm going to run a pilot, and I'm going to experiment with this. I mean, when you're working on really super thin margins, there's not a lot of room for experimentation. But with some funding, it allows farmers to expand their production techniques, change something, experiment with value added. And those kinds of efforts will actually really support not only local food systems like we talk about them, but even just the idea of localizing existing production, which is currently has customers elsewhere that are not in the community. So absolutely, I think policy and funding are a big part of it. And ultimately, if we do not get our heads on straight on this idea that food is not, it's not free, just because it is grown from soil doesn't mean that it, you know, you throw a seed down, step on it, wait for it to rain and it comes up. Like, why would I pay for that? That's not how it works. We've got to get our heads on straight about paying the true cost of growing food. And when we do that, it all opens up.
And it'll be so transformative. I mean, just no downside. And I really do believe that. So I hope to see, like, I was watching a special the other night because of all of the drought protocols we're going to be implementing, and seeing this nice couple who own a big farm up in closer to the Phoenix. I'm in Tucson, and I was struggling to feel their pain. And I thought, this is when you think, Gina, you're not a nice person. But what I hope they will do is look. They said, we'll just have to let those fields, you know, just, we won't be able to grow anything on them. And I thought, yes, mm-hmm. you can. If you just watch Kiss the Ground and start some regenerative agriculture. I know that's not an answer to everything, but it is an answer to contributing to the healthy cycle of what we need to have happen in the face of climate change. So I want to know, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Gina, I just wanted to add one point on that. The farmers, I really do not, of all the people to blame, I probably blame our economic system the most.
Thanks for telling me that. Yes, go on.
And the farmers, I do not tend to blame, because they are trying to work within an economic system that they've
right.
been told
right.
is the one that they need to work within. They're getting hammered on these commodity prices. They're always under pressure. I mean, these large farms often, you know, really have margins that are as thin as these small farms. The pieces that are really needed here, here's an interesting thought. We do not have an entrepreneurial water system.
To say the least. Oh my gosh, I mean, you're so right.
And we don't have an entrepreneurial safety system, public safety.
True.
Or education. Most of it is not entrepreneurial.
True.
Because in an entrepreneurial system, you can only get what you can afford. And there's some recognition that we all need clean water and education is important. But somehow, our food system is always entrepreneurial. The risk of innovation, the risk of better, is always put straight back on the farmer. And we as consumers typically say to the farmer, okay, here's what you should be doing. You should be using these practices, growing these crops, and that's the right thing to do. And then turn around and say, but don't you dare raise your prices. because I'm not willing to pay for it.
I know. It's so sad. And thank you for saying it on this show, because we have thousands of listeners that are going to resonate with this or think about it for the first time. It's so true.
It's a lot of burden to put on individual business owners who are feeding us.
Yes.
Now, you know, I suppose the other side of that, the large swing in alternatives, is to say, okay, we have a public food system. And I can already hear all the arguments of why that doesn't work and why we shouldn't do it. And
really that's okay. Scary.
Yeah. I don't know that it's the right thing, but we as consumers have to participate in the risk and reward. All we want to do is participate in the reward.
Yep, it's so true. And we just have to rethink. I had to do this when I first started in my journey of Mrs. Green. You have to redo your budget. Literally, you have to rethink, this is what I pay for this. I don't think anything of it. But I don't want to pay more than this for that. And to rethink just what your money is going to and how much power there is in that decision. So most unfortunately, we're almost to the end. And I want to know if there's anything that you were dying for me to ask and I did not, or any final comments you want to share, because this has been delightful for me. I've been smiling for almost 1 hour. That's always a good sign.
Well, this has been absolutely lovely. So I am just so grateful. And I know we could talk for hours and hours about these issues.
We could do a marathon.
Yeah. And you've covered so much ground. So there's nothing really burning. The only thing I would kind of hope to leave the listeners with is the idea that we were talking about going and buying, you know, like getting your latte, right, and spending $7 on it versus getting a dozen eggs and complaining that they're $6. I would like people to consider re-embracing the feeling of nourishing the people we love by cooking for them.
That's great.
And that act is incredibly powerful. And in that way, cooking isn't something we don't have time for. It's something we make time for because it is an essential bond between ourselves, the people we love, and the earth. And it's ancient, and it's definitely worth reliving.
And I can't believe it. We could go like for the next hour on that, because my background is in social services with at-risk children and families. There are programs now in Tucson with one of our big El Rio Community Health Centers where children who are obese get some type of like faux prescription from their pediatrician to attend healthy cooking classes at a place called Tucson Village Farm with their parents. And Brian, the results have been transformative in terms of the children's behavior in school, their absenteeism, the family dynamics. Eating together as a family is really a great thing to do. I mean, it matters, and preparing the food. And I don't cook, so there you have it. I don't, and I don't feel guilty about it. My husband cooks, and I gather, and I set a beautiful table, and I come up with what ideas are. And the reason I don't cook is because I hate to chop. Chop, 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 chop. I just put my knife down one day and said, this is really boring. So my husband's really good at it. But the eat, like my grandchildren are here right now, and we cannot wait to go outside tonight when it cools down and all sit around the table and have dinner. So this is just delightful. The power, the healing power of cooking and food. I couldn't agree with you more. And I have a few last words. I love everything about farmers markets. I love the energy, the families, the smells, the sense of community, the people who are there selling things, knowing with my heart that they put their hearts and souls into whatever they are selling. There's just no downside. When I go to a farmers market, I feel like everything is right about the world for just a bit. But what has occurred to me preparing for this show is that this is one area that the pandemic hit so hard and so suddenly and so dramatically, and I never gave it much thought. I was sad when my favorite foot scrub ran out, and I really missed having my favorite heirloom tomatoes, but I didn't sit with the impact of COVID and what it had on all those friendly faces that I looked forward to seeing every week, both here and last summer in New Mexico. So what Brian has done has helped me to remember. Remember why I love them. Remember why I think farmers markets are such a wonderful part of our community. And he reminded me to really commit to getting out there again to supporting them. And I hope that all of you who are listening will think about doing the same thing and spreading the word, because as we all know, that is how real change happens. So thanks, Brian, for showing up in my life today and for getting me to remember and to refocus. It was really great spending time with you.
Thank you, Gina. It's been wonderful.
Really great. We'll spread the word. And of course, my final thanks is always to you, our listeners, because without you, there would be no us. So let's get out there and make a difference for this great planet of ours. And what a great way to do it, going to a farmer's market. So thank you, Brian. Our paths will cross, I'm sure of it.
Absolutely.